We're going chapter by chapter, verse by verse on Wednesday nights. We are currently going through the book of 1 Samuel. And last week we covered two chapters. I know, amazing. Yep, two chapters. We studied chapter 5 and chapter 6, where the ark was in Philistine possession. It was captured by the Philistines after victories over the Israelites, two victories. And they decided that it would be a good idea to put that, the Ark of the Covenant, in their temple to their god Dagon, or Dagon. And that did not work out very well for Dagon. This was a battle between the gods that was playing itself out in religious artifacts, so we got to see the results. But long story short, on the morning of the second day, the statue of Dagon was laying on the ground, all busted up. Jerry, it was a daggone shame for that to happen. You know what I mean? Just the Lord absolutely embarrassed that false god, Dagon. And that began a game of hot potato with the Ark of the Covenant. The Philistines were now passing it off from city to city. It's causing us problems. You take it. No, it's causing us problems. You take it. And on that went for a while until the Lord started to turn the heat up a little bit, to get the point across that he wanted the ark to be returned to his people, the nation of Israel. And they could handle it for a while. The swellings, they could handle. The outbreak of mice, they could handle that. But when people started dying, like lots of people started dying, that's when they finally cried uncle and said, we've got to get this thing out of Philistine control and back to the nation of Israel. So they stuck it on a new cart and they strapped two milk cows to it, and they turned them loose and said, whatever the cows do with it, fine. We just want it gone. If it goes to Beth Shemesh, the Levitical city there in Israel, then we'll know this was definitely the Lord trying to give us signs and tell us he wanted the ark to go back to the land of Israel. So they were happy to let it go. And it was a glorious day for Israel because that ark, they didn't even have to do anything to get it back. The Lord just didn't want the Philistines to have it. He wanted the nation of Israel to have it. And so the Lord did this all on his own without their help. And the ark just shows up in the city of Beth Shemesh, a Levitical city. Happens to show up right at a big rock that was a ready-made altar. And so they got the hint from the Lord. They used the wood from the cart as fire for the altar. They used the two Philistine milk cows as sacrifices, offerings to the Lord, and there were Levites and priests in that city that could handle the ark and carry forth the offering to the Lord. And what a wonderful and glorious day that was for Israel for a little while. But then, unfortunately, 70 curious men decided to either look upon the ark or actually look into the ark. And as the Lord says in the book of Hosea, through the prophet Hosea, chapter 4, verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Curiosity got the best of those 70 men. They did not know the law of Moses, and that ended up becoming the death of them. There were two barbecues that day. Two milk cows were barbecued, but then 70 men barbecued because they did not know the word of the Lord, and they were doing an improper and indecent thing, a sacrilegious thing pertaining to the Ark of the Covenant. So 70 men dead. Naturally, then at the end of chapter 6, the people of Beth Shemesh, they are trying to get rid of this thing. They want the Ark gone now as well. They think to themselves, we have no idea what we're doing. If we hang on to this thing, we're going to end up getting more people killed. So let's call the people in Beth Shemesh, Kiriath Yidim, let's have them come over, assuming that means that these were the professionals. They knew in Kiriath Yidim how to handle the Ark of the Covenant, and they want those folks from that city to take it. It's like the Ark has gone nuclear on them, and they don't want that to happen again. So they're bringing in the professional hazmat team, the team that knows how to do it, the people from Kiriath Yidim. They turn the ark over to them and give it to the professionals to handle. That's a smart move. That's a good move on their part. Dangerous stuff is best left handled by the professionals and your enemies. Write that down. You're going to need that later. Kidding about the last part. But verse 1, the professionals of Kiriath Yearim, apparently more acquainted with the Word of God and God's laws regarding how to handle the Ark of the Covenant, they show up to take the Ark. It says, and the men of Kiriath Yearim came and took up the Ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And Abinadab means the father of nobleness. His house is chosen to be the storage facility for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. They have no tabernacle, so they can't put it in the tabernacle I shared with you last week. The Shiloh was destroyed after that second battle, that second loss to the Philistines. So there's really nothing they can do with it at the moment except for store it. And reading on, it says, they consecrated his son, Abinadab's son, Eleazar, to have charge of the Ark of the Lord. There's a name that's familiar to us, Eleazar. That means God has helped. And it is a very priestly name. In fact, the first time we saw that name come up in the Old Testament scriptures, that was during the lifetime of Moses. And it was the third son of Aaron. And that Eleazar was a priest. This is a different Eleazar, of course, that we're speaking about in 1 Samuel chapter 7. But it is also a priest. This guy is a priest, and the reason I know that is because they put him through the Old Testament rite of priestly consecration. Do you see that at the end of verse 1? He is consecrated here to be a priest, so he is legit. Now, I would love to really get inside the heads of the home here that's housing the Ark and really ponder over their thoughts, because I wonder what they were thinking. I think personally for me, it would be a little bit unnerving to have the Ark of the Covenant in storage in my house, knowing that the thing just went nuclear and killed a bunch of people, knowing that there were very serious rules about how to handle this thing, what to do with it, what not to do with it, knowing that the consequences of violating those laws were very serious in the eyes of the Lord. I think it'd be petrifying to have it in my home. I can just imagine my conversations with my kids. Kids, keep your voice down. Whatever you do, don't argue. We don't want to make the Ark of the Lord mad again. But they have this bomb, as it were, ready to go off, stored in their house. And then we're told in verse 2, by the way, it does end up working out for them. They're fine. In verse 2, from the day that the Ark was lodged at Kiriath Yearim, or Kirjath Jearim, if you're reading this from the King James Version, a long time passed, says verse 2, some 20 years. So hopefully you caught that. There is a 20-year gap between the Ark's arrival in Kiriath Yearim and the events of the rest of this chapter that we're studying tonight. In other words, 20 years pass between reading verse 2 and verse 3. So that would put Samuel here in his 30s now. We had good reason to believe that he was about 3 or 4 years old when he was dropped off at the tabernacle and given to Eli to be dedicated to the Lord all the days of his life. We have good reason to believe that Samuel was approximately 13 or 14 years old, 10 years later, when he received his call from the Lord to be a prophet. And now you just add 20 years to that, and that puts him at about the age 33, which is a significant age in the Bible record, if you know what I'm talking about. Potentially as old as 34, 35 years old, as young as 32, but somewhere in that ballpark. So he's an adult. He's kind of coming into his own in prophetic ministry. You'll see that. He's very active in prophetic ministry from this point forward. Now, overall, the Ark would remain in storage in Kiriath Yearim for about 100 years total, from the time that it's dropped off to the time that King David finally calls for it and has it relocated to Jerusalem. But then, I mean, you have the wait between King David, King Solomon, and the construction of King Solomon's temple. The Ark waits a very long period of time in storage, first in Kiriath Yearim, then in Jerusalem, but it's not in its proper place until Solomon gets the temple built, with David's help, of course. And then finally, the Ark can be put where it's supposed to be, the Holy of Holies, in the temple, Solomon's temple. and then actually be utilized as it was supposed to. So it's a long wait for the Ark of the Covenant, and really not a lot going on with the Ark. It says, reading on in verse 2, that all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. This is good. This is a good thing. This is the beginning stages of a national revival for the nation of Israel, and a rather significant one, I would add. They got close to revival back in chapter 6 during that worship session. The cows come back, and the cows come home, and they had the ark with them. Praise God, the Lord delivered the ark. Better than DoorDash, it's here. And now we're having this worship session. We're offering sacrifices to the Lord. I think if there was no catastrophe on that day, that could have been it. That could have just launched them into revival. But that tragedy of the loss of those 70 men because of the Ark of the Covenant, I don't know, I'm just speculating here, but it seems like that may have sent the nation of Israel mixed messages. You know the flower thing, he loves me not. The ark is home. He loves us. 70 men dead because of the ark. He loves us not. We're confused. Lord, what's happening here? And it would seem that that kind of set them back for 20 years. 20 years of, as we read in verse 2, lamenting after the Lord, wanting the Lord, wanting a relationship with him, wanting to get back to him, missing that relationship that they had with God. And yet, maybe a little bit fearful because of what happened 20 years ago to really act on that. But thank the Lord, now we have Samuel coming into his own in prophetic ministry. And in verse 3, Samuel outlines a very clear path back to the Lord for the nation of Israel. Check this out. He says in verse 3, "And Samuel said to all the house of Israel, 'If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines.'" Now you might want to make note of this verse, because in just one verse, Samuel has given us really the four steps for personal and therefore national revival. This was given for Israel, four steps for Israel's personal and therefore national revival, or spiritual reformation, if you prefer. And it reads just the way it should read for us. This works exactly the same for us as it did for the nation of Israel. So if you are wanting revival in your Christianity, if you're wanting spiritual reformation in your life, this renewal before the Lord for your family, for your community, your city, your state, your country, well, this is the passage. These are the steps. And these are always the steps. This always works. Step number one, Samuel said, return to the Lord with all your heart. That is coming back to valuing your relationship with the Lord, letting that mean everything to you, and really getting your heart behind that. Your whole heart has to be committed to that. Step number two, Samuel said, was, in my own words, make God number one. Put away all of the false gods, all other gods. Anything in your life that you have put on a platform above God, it's been a theme in our studies lately. Anything above God in your life, that has got to go. And the Lord has got to be number one. Step number three was direct your heart to the Lord. And that is different than step one, returning to the Lord with all your heart. That's the first step of this. That's the first turn to the Lord. But directing your heart to the Lord is different in that it's just not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing act. It is ongoing action of continuously directing your heart to the Lord. Because you know how this works. The enemy is going to use the world to try to redirect your heart away from the Lord. Over and over again, every day of your life, the enemy's trying to get a hook in you and drag you into being more interested in the temporal things of life rather than the eternal things. So that's your responsibility to stay on top of that. It's your responsibility to just continuously be directing your heart back to the Lord. You'll feel it get pulled away. You'll feel your vision taken off the Lord at times. There's just no way around that. And when you do, you stay on top of that and you direct your heart back to the Lord. And then step number four, according to Samuel, was serve the Lord alone. Serve the Lord alone. I shouldn't have to tell you, but service is a part of life. We all serve. Whether we want to accept that or not, we are all called into the service. We are serving someone or something in our lives, and our service will always betray any false professions that we may have. We can say that our profession is this: I'm serving the Lord. But when you say that, you realize the rest of us can see you, right? We can see your life. We can see your service. And we can tell if you're really, truly matching up with your profession. Your profession is going to be betrayed by your service if you're not serving the Lord. If you're professing a relationship with God, there will be evidence. You cannot be a whole believer just on good beliefs and good intentions alone. But the Bible teaches us that your salvation is going to materialize into service. It's going to play itself out, work itself out through good works. And that service to the Lord, it really needs to be sincere and singular. That your service has to be to the Lord and to the Lord alone. As Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, you cannot serve two masters. It does not work. You will either love the one and hate the other, or cling or be devoted to the one and not the other. You're going to pick one eventually. And then the example he gives is you cannot serve God and money. I wonder why he picked that one. Okay, no, I don't wonder. I know why he picked that one. Money is a very popular God. You can't serve both. You can't make money your God and say that you're a servant of the Lord as well. You're going to have to pick one, and whether that's money or possessions or whatever else could exist as a God in your life, you can't serve both. It's the Lord and nothing else, or it is nothing at all. So those are the four steps to revival or spiritual reformation. Those are always the four steps. They always work from Old Testament to New Testament. They always work. Verse 4. So the people of Israel put away the Baals. They bailed on Baal. I like that. And the Ashtaroth. And they served the Lord only. That was Samuel's counsel. And they took his counsel. Verse 5. Then Samuel said, gather all Israel at Mizpah. Does anyone remember what Mizpah means? We had a study on this, a couple actually. We've mentioned it a couple times. Mizpah means the Lord keep a watch on you, but remember, it's not like a positive thing. It doesn't mean, oh, may the Lord watch over you. What it actually means is, I don't trust you. I don't trust you any further than I can throw you. So may the Lord keep his eye on you and watch for anything shady that you might be doing. That's really the meaning of this word, Mizpah. So gather all Israel at Mizpah. And Samuel says, I will pray to the Lord for you. Verse 6. So they gathered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord. So that was a very symbolic act. They were expressing outwardly what they were experiencing inwardly. This is always the way with the New Testament rites that we have, whether it's communion, if we're observing communion, or whether we're conducting a baptism. Those are always outward expressions of inward truths or inward experiences. That's exactly what this is. It says in the book of Lamentations, chapter 2, verse 19, pour out your hearts like water before the presence of the Lord. That is what they're symbolizing here. By pouring the water on the ground, they're symbolizing, Lord, I'm pouring my whole heart out to you. That means I'm committing it to you. I'm giving it to you. The point of the symbolism is that pouring water onto dry ground, that's a permanent thing. You can't undo that. You know how they say you can't unscramble an egg? I think that's true. Has anyone ever, you know, successfully done it? I'm pretty sure that's true. You can't unscramble an egg. And just as well, you can't recover water once you've poured it out onto dry ground. You could try that. Like, you know, you're drinking last couple sips of your water bottle. Okay, I'm done. Poured out. No, wait. One more sip. No, it's too late. You lost that water. It's a permanent thing. And that's the symbolism here for the heart. My heart, Lord, our heart as a nation, we're pouring it out to you. We're giving it to you. We're committing it to you. And we can't take it back. We won't take it back. That's what they're saying to the Lord. Reading on in verse 6. And they fasted on that day, which is a way of showing the Lord that he is more important to your soul than food is to your body. And the Lord knows when a believer is fasting, something serious is up. I mean, they really need me at this moment in their life. If a human being is sacrificing food to communicate with me or to get something for me or to have a need filled, well, then they must be in a point of very serious need. That gets the Lord's attention. And they fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. That's confession. And Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. And that means this was, you know, an ongoing thing. He judged them. He served as a judge for them. That includes hearing disputes between two folks that were arguing or two parties that were scuffling over something and then settling those disputes. So it was very courtroom kind of stuff. But it was also giving judgments to people that would come to Samuel and say things like this, Samuel, I really don't know the Lord very well. I'm new at this. I don't know really what the Lord stands for. I don't know the law. And so I'm asking your counsel, Samuel, what should I do in this situation? Samuel, what can you help me to decipher between right and wrong? How does God feel about this? Can you guide me in godly decisions? Stuff like that would be brought to Samuel. And he would hear those issues and settle those issues. It was civil judgments and it was spiritual judgments. You could even say Bible teaching. You know, he was really teaching people the law of God when they would come to him. How does God feel about my situation? Okay, here's what God said in Leviticus, whatever. So it was civil work, government work, but it was also spiritual and ministry work. Israel did not have separation of church and state. Remember the law of Moses, that was everything for the nation. That was how you live your life religiously. That was how you live your life civilly. And really any question that a person could have about life for the nation of Israel, that all pointed back to one place, the Word of God in the Torah. So just a reminder before we move on here that Samuel is a judge over Israel in the official capacity. That's what we're seeing here. Samuel is the final judge during the time period of the judges. And if you recall, the position of judge was essentially a position of rule. It was pretty similar to the position of a king or a monarchy. It is really tough to figure out if there were any differences between the judge's ruling and a king ruling. Really, the only differences that I clearly see are in the fact that in the monarchy, there was planned succession. I always say secession first. I don't know why. There was planned succession. When one king was passing on, there was someone to step up and take his place. And under the rule of judges, that really wasn't the case. The Lord just raised him up when times got really bad and they helped out for a while and then they passed on. And then things would get bad for a while because they didn't really have anyone ruling over them. And God would raise up another judge. Long periods of time in between. Apart from that, it's really tough to sit down and figure out what the differences in authority and rule were between judges and king. Pretty similar, but that's Samuel. He is a judge. He's a ruler over the nation of Israel. That's not the only hat he wears. This guy has a lot of hats. Remember, he was a Levite. So that means he is a tabernacle worker. That's how he started his life in ministry, as a tabernacle worker. I know there's no tabernacle right now, but there's still tabernacle work. We're going to read about it in this chapter. We read about it in chapter 6. There's still tabernacle work. And even though there's no tabernacle, he's going to be doing tabernacle work. He's a Levite. He's a tabernacle worker, right? He's an official judge or ruler over the nation. And then don't forget, He is an official prophet, and I mean prophet like in the official authoritative capacity. He's all three of these things. He's wearing many hats. He's pulling triple duty, just like some of you at work, because no one else wants to work these days. So you're doing the job of two and three people, and no one will apply. No one wants to work. And that happens in ministry a lot as well. The Lord has to have those who are working pull a lot of extra labor, more than their fair share of labor, just because there's not a whole lot to do the work. As Jesus said in both Matthew chapter 9 and Luke verse 10, the harvest is plentiful. There's plenty of work to do in the kingdom, but the laborers are few. So Jesus said to say, you guys need to pray for laborers. And that can be the case for many churches that can really struggle with this, having few workers, and the workers that they do have are overworked. Thankfully here at Anchored, I think we do pretty well at that. We have a lot of people distributing the workload. We have a lot of people helping out. I'm so grateful for that. That helps to keep the wheels turning on this thing. Well, I guess Anchored would be that. That helps to keep us. Well, that ruins the Anchored analogy. Never mind. An anchored ship doesn't move. You know, I kind of hung myself up on my words there. Now, we do pretty well there. We are thin in some areas of ministry for sure, but that's temporary. The Lord is working. He's already moving pieces in place. We trust the Lord with that. So when the time comes for us to need more workers in specific areas, the Lord will pull that all together. He always does. Verse 7. Now, when the Philistines heard that the people of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. Now, keep in mind, this was a religious gathering for Israel. But the Philistines don't know that. They just see a bunch of people gathering around and they assume the worst. They panic. They figure it must be a military gathering. And that makes them nervous. And what do nervous Philistines do? They attack. A lot of people are like that, too. They're just always suspicious that you're going to attack them. So they're always like sitting on go, ready to launch into attack mode against you preemptively, ready to beat you to the punch. You know people like that, right? You have to watch your countenance around them. You have to be very careful with your words, because, man, if you say something that can be taken wrong, or you have an even slightly cross look on your face, here comes the fight. But the lords of the Philistines thought this was a military gathering, so they went up against Israel. And when the people of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. It's still fresh in Israel's mind. What happened the last time that they fought against the Philistines? They squared off against them and they got their backsides handed to them. They got beat rather badly. So, yes, of course they're afraid. But they don't need to be this time. There's some big changes this time. They have returned to the Lord. And that's going to be the difference in all areas here. So they're fine. They're safe. They don't know that. They're filled with fear. Samuel actually had already given God's word to them on this. They had this promise from Samuel. If you'll take these four steps to revival, if you'll return to the Lord, then verse 3, God will deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines. God's going to give you the victory. That was the promise of the Lord. Return to me and I will give you victory over the Philistines. And so, yeah, they were going to be just fine. They didn't know that, but they were going to be just fine. So will you, by the way, if you compare yourself to that one little promise that this group of Israelites had from the Lord. Think about how much better off you are, how many more promises you have from the Lord about his provision, his providence, his protection in your life. So I don't know what you're going through. I don't know how tough it might seem to you, but you are going to be okay. The Lord is going to pull you through. The Lord is going to give you the victory. He is. You can trust him. Verse 7, now when the Philistines heard, we read that. Verse 8, and the people of Israel said to Samuel, Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us. Samuel, we are going to battle. We're going to fight the Philistines. We're petrified, but we're going to do it. We want you to stay here and pray. And don't stop praying until the battle's over. I like that role. I think that would have been my pick that day. Yeah, you guys go out. You handle the fighting. I'll stay here and pray for you all. Very good job that Samuel had. And it says that he may save us from the hands of the Philistines. Pray that for us, Samuel, that the Lord will give us the victory. Last time, when they were afraid of battle against the Philistines, they turned to the Ark of God. But this time, they turned to the God of the Ark. So they are in a much better headspace right now. They've learned their lesson. Remember what they said last time? Call up the ark. Let's take the ark out there so that it may save us. What did they say this time? So that he may save us. Do you see how much better they're doing right now? They're not trusting in the ark, the it. They're trusting in the him. They're trusting in God for their battle. So they're now marching on faith, trusting in their God. And I like the fact that they did this. They ask for prayer help. That's always a very good decision. Ask for help. If you know you're heading into a battle or a challenge in life and you're a little bit concerned about the stability of your faith and you think that maybe at some point in that battle, there's a chance that your faith might get a little bit weak, then this is what you do. You ask for prayer help. And go to brothers and sisters in Christ and ask them to pray for you. Go to the church leaders, ask them to pray for you. Ask me. I have time to pray for you. I do. I will pray for you. And prayer really matters. And sometimes it's the only thing that matters. And prayer really helps. And sometimes it is the only thing that can really help. So depend on that. Get prayer when you need it. Verse 9. So Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Okay, now, tricky verse. I had alluded to this verse before when I had talked to you about Samuel and his lineage. He is not a descendant of Aaron. I shared with you before that means that according to the law of Moses, he can only be a Levite. He cannot serve as a priest. He cannot conduct sacrifices. He can't do the work of a priest without transgressing the laws of Moses. So this verse really complicates that whole thing for us. You read that with me, right? It sure sounded like Samuel just made an offering, like as if he was a priest, that he sacrificed this animal to the Lord. And it is possible that that happened, but I don't want to be so quick to jump to that conclusion here. I know people read this verse and they say, well, that settles it. Samuel was a priest. Well, I don't know that he was. Okay, because if we are going strictly by the law of Moses, then there's no way Samuel could have been a priest or could have functioned in the capacity of priest. Without violating the law of Moses, is it possible that God made an exception for Samuel? Yes, that is possible. God is God. He can do what he wants. And making exceptions to the law of Moses would not be unprecedented. The Lord did do that on occasion. He did do that from time to time. Usually it was because of pressing need. If God only had one course of action and it violated his law, sometimes he would make that exception. It's possible he did that with Samuel. But we just read that there was a guy named Eleazar that was in charge of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. He's a priest. He's a legitimate priest. So what I want to do is just get you thinking momentarily, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but just to get you thinking momentarily that if we're looking at this strictly adhering to the law of Moses, assuming that Samuel would be also strictly adhering to the law of Moses, there is another way to look at this. And that would be that Samuel, when it mentions Samuel as making an offering to the Lord, that all that is really telling us in verse 9 and also in verse 10, we didn't get there yet, but all it's really telling us is that Samuel made an offering to the Lord. And that means he is an offerer in that situation. It does not necessarily mean that he is serving as a priest and actually sacrificing that animal. It just means he's the offerer. And that there very well could have been a priest there that was taking that offering from Samuel and doing the work for his offering on behalf of the nation of Israel. If you look at it in that way, literally anyone in the nation of Israel could have been an offerer of a sacrifice. I think that holds true. If you live back in that time, you were a part of the nation of Israel and you brought a sin offering or a consecration offering or a fellowship offering, a peace offering. You were an offerer and you brought your offering to the Lord. And here's my offering. I'm an offerer. But that didn't make you a priest, and you didn't do the work of the priest for your offering. You still had a priest that did that work. It's very possible that that's what has happened here. Samuel will never do this again, at least not as recorded in the Bible. Now, he will talk about it again in chapter 10. He's going to tell King Saul that I want you to wait for me. Don't do anything till I get there. When I show up at a certain time, I'm going to make these offerings on your behalf. And you get to chapter 13, you realize Saul was a very impatient guy. He waited. Samuel did not show up when he said he would. And so what did Saul do? Saul performed those offerings himself. He did it himself. He did the work of a high priest. And that ended up being the thing that cost Saul his crown. So that's another thing that kind of seems like Samuel is saying that he's going to do the work of the priest there in chapter 10, even though he doesn't get a chance to do it. Chapter 13, Saul does it. Again, though, that is not definitely telling us that Samuel's intentions were to go there with these offerings and then perform the work of the offerings himself. It very well may be that he would be traveling with an entourage of ministry. Levites to help, priests to handle the offering, so we can't make that assumption. Here's all we can really say either way. For sure we can say that Samuel is either not a priest at all in any way, or he is serving as a priest, but very unofficially and very unconventionally, just because of sheer need on behalf of the Lord. So that's kind of where I stand on this. I don't know where you do, but honestly, all things considered, I figure it probably matters pretty little to you whether Samuel was an official priest or not. I doubt your salvation is going to be rocked tonight by whether or not Samuel is or is not, was or was not a priest. Oh man, Arlen said he wasn't. I can't do this anymore. No, I doubt that's going to happen. So I'll leave that for you to study. It's complicated. Verse 10. As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, which again very well could have been carried out by a priest, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. And when war threatened and the enemy is close, starting a fire is a terrible idea. That's sending smoke signals to your enemy. That's telling them exactly where you are. They're having a worship service here. They got the fires on the altar going. There's a big smoke signal announcing to the Philistines, hey, we're all here having a community worship service. We're vulnerable right now. But listen, when threatened with war and with the enemy close, starting an altar fire is always a good idea. It's always a good idea. And it doesn't matter if the smoke's gone up. It doesn't matter if your altar fire gives away your position. That's always a good idea, because an altar fire is always going to alter the outcome in your favor. It's always going to result in good for you. So watch this. Watch how this works for the nation of Israel. Watch how this altar fire does not ruin them, as it normally would for most nations. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel. Pretty incredible, right? It was a wonderful victory for them. not the most important of the chapter. The biggest victory in that chapter was their return to the Lord. That was the thing that mattered most, and everything else mattered way less. But everything else did matter. It mattered that they won this battle, and this was a great victory for the nation. And all the Lord had to do to make this victory happen was to make some noise, was to crack some thunder, and then Israel wins because their enemies are confused. Now, I'm sure you've become familiar with the concept of a diversion. I'm sure you've heard of that before and know what it is. I mean, it's in just about every action, adventure, and thriller movie that they make or TV show. You know what a diversion is. That's trying to draw the attention away from where you don't want the danger to be. You're creating a diversion. You're pulling attention somewhere else so that you're fine where you are. Well, that's exactly what the Lord did for the nation of Israel and their worship service. The Lord caused a diversion. He confused the Philistines. They were marching toward the smoke signal, the announcement of where the nation was, but the Lord confused them with the thunderings and you know, the loud noises, the sound, the confusion, the discombobulation, the disorientation of the Philistines somehow ended up giving the Israelites an advantageous position from which they could attack and defeat the enemies, the Philistines, or at least that's the way that it would seem to me. So this reminds us of the need for church security. That's a must. It reminds us of that. That during our church services, we are most vulnerable, especially the pastor. The pastor is always up front with a great big bullseye on him. There's no one in front of him. If you were standing level with the crowd, there's at least a chance someone else catches the bullet for you. But if you're standing up on the stage, you got a big target on you for someone with ill intentions. But though it's a reminder about the need for church security, it's also a reminder that the Lord, when he doesn't want a service disturbed, when he wants to protect worshipers, that there's nothing that's going to stop that. And he has unlimited resources. And the things that he can do to create diversions and to bring about the safety of his people. So humanly speaking, we are very vulnerable during church time. But spiritually speaking, when we factor in the Lord being our protector and our victor, we're just fine. We know nothing is going to happen to us that has not received the permission and the allowance of the Lord. I've seen so many videos that prove this very thing, you know. The attacker slips. The target moves just the right way at just the right moment. The gun doesn't go off. Over and over we see these videos and we're amazed at the Lord. Lord, it's so easy for you to do that, to protect us. It makes you wonder why we're so fearful about things like that, doesn't it? We should probably trust the Lord a lot more than we do. Verse 11. And the men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Beth-kar. Now, we don't know who this Beth is and why she parked so far away, but no, I'm kidding. It's just a bad joke that you come to expect from me as your pastor, and I'm happy to deliver. And I never want to disappoint you. Beth-kar means the house of the Lamb. So the enemies were driven below the house of the Lamb. I'll let you make your own applications of that. Verse 12. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen. Shen means tooth. And called its name Ebenezer. Ebenezer means stone of help. For he said, till now the Lord has helped us. So I like that. They set up that Ebenezer stone because, well, so far, this is going okay. We turn back to the Lord. So far, he's working everything out. It's thanking God for the thus far. Thanking God for being with us thus far. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4, it was in the city of Ebenezer that Israel lost those two battles. And then had the Ark of the Covenant captured by the Philistines. So commemorating this victory with an Ebenezer stone is a way of connecting those defeats and kind of putting the capstone on those defeats and saying, okay, well, yeah, but, you know, we lost those battles in Ebenezer, but we turned back to the Lord. And thus far, since we've turned back to the Lord, look what's happening. We're winning. The Lord is blessing us and all is well. A monumental victory for the nation. Memorial stones or pillars of memorial stones were used quite often in the Old Testament scriptures, weren't they? We first see Jacob setting up a memorial pillar for the Lord. Moses did that at Mount Sinai. Joshua did that. He set up two pillars of stones. Remember, one in the middle of the Jordan, of course, when the ground was dry during the crossing, and then one on the west side after they crossed. He set up another pillar of stones. And now here we have Samuel setting up a single stone as a pillar or as a memorial stone or as an Ebenezer stone. Why do God's people need memorial stones? Why do we need Ebenezer stones to say the Lord has been with us thus far? We need that, and we've talked about this before in our studies. We need that because of our very poor memories. That's why we need that. We need those constant reminders that, oh yeah, that's right, the Lord won this battle for me. And if we don't do that, if we don't set up these Ebenezer stones in our life, then what ends up happening is that we get into the next battle and we forget that the Lord has ever helped us before. We like forget everything we know. We lose our trust in Him because we're not remembering correctly in the sheer panic of the moment. Now, I wouldn't suggest that you need physical Ebenezer stones. I mean, if you want to do that, that's fine. Set a big rock outside your house and put a plaque on it when your friends come over. What's that? Well, that's because the Lord helped me through this spiritual battle, so there's that stone. What about all the stones in the backyard? Yeah, those are more Ebenezer stones. If you want to do that, that's fine, but it doesn't have to be an Ebenezer stone physically for us in the New Testament. But I do think there are good ways to implement that. It can be something as simply as just monuments that you put up in your mind so that you won't remember. It can be notes that you jot down so that you don't remember. It can be things that you hang on your wall. But all of those things are Ebenezer stones in our walk with the Lord. Some of you old timers, and don't be offended, I include myself in that statement. Some of you old timers, you're familiar with the song, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. That was written in 1758. And the first line of that second verse reads like this. Here I raise my Ebenezer. Hither by thy help I'm come. That was the first line of the second verse of that song. That is a reference to the verse that we're studying today. And it is an acknowledgement of what I just said. A very good usage for modern versions of personal Ebenezer stones in our lives to remind us of what God has done for us thus far. Now, with that said, I have already decided on what I am getting all of you for Christmas 2025. I'm buying all of you Ebenezer stones. Well, actually, they're just stones until you take a permanent marker and write a victory on them. Then they'll be Ebenezer stones. But that's what I'm getting you all for Christmas. Hey, don't worry about how much it cost me. You guys are worth it. So you can expect that from me come Christmas time. Unless the Lord talks me out of it. Verse 13. So the Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. Verse 14. The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel. You hearing all this? From Ekron to Gath. That means all those five major cities of the Philistines. Listen to this. And Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. They got all that land back. There was peace also between Israel and the Amorites. This is pretty wild stuff, folks. Pretty incredible advancement and spiritual blessing for the nation of Israel. That tells us that this return to the Lord by the nation was an extensive one and an extended one. I say extensive in the sense that it wasn't just a handful of people in the nation that had returned back to the Lord. And I say extended in the sense that it wasn't just like a few months of trying and then, I don't know. Kind of want to keep my options open, explore other gods. This was an extensive revival and an extended one. This was a very long period of faithfulness from the nation of Israel in honoring their God, a very long period of time where God was rewarding their faithfulness and fulfilling His promise to bless them, to beat their enemies, to give them prosperity in the land, the stuff they had been wanting all the way back to the days in Egypt. Unfortunately for us, we don't get to read about that. We should like have years and years and years of reading about hundreds of incredible, wonderful things from the nation of Israel during this time period of faithfulness. Unfortunately, you know how it works. It's the bad stuff that makes the news headlines. So when things are good, usually, quick pass. Yep, things were good for 30 years, 40 years. Okay, next, let's come to the next bad thing where the Lord had to bail someone out. Just look at the life of Enoch. What do we know about Enoch? Like nothing. All we know is that Enoch walked with the Lord. You know, all his life he walked with the Lord, and then the Lord took him. Why do you think we don't get all the stories about the drama, the bad stuff, the struggles in Enoch's life, to give us lessons to learn from as weak Christians? Why do you think we don't have that? Probably because the guy was just a good, faithful servant of the Lord, and he didn't have that drama to share. So that's his story. Enoch walked with God, and then he was not. The Lord took him. I'm happy with that kind of life. That's how the Lord has to summarize my life. Well, did a good job. Good, faithful servant. All right, next. Hey, I'm good with that. I'm good with that. I hope you are too. So the Lord is quiet about this extensive and extended period of Israel's faithfulness. But look to the fruit of that. We just read it. Look to the fruit of that. The Philistines were beat back. They regained all of the land of the Philistines. The Philistines were all but non-existent for a while, for a long time. Now that's going to change, but for the moment, Israel gained all of that ground back. They had beat the Philistines, and they had even become allies with the Amorites from the east side of the Jordan. They were allies with the Philistines prior to this, but now in Israel's time period of faithfulness, after having beat the Philistines, the Amorites now ally themselves with the nation of Israel. Things are just amazing for the nation at this time. So I want to read a couple verses to you that kind of summarize this. 2 Chronicles 7:14. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land. How about this? Psalm 33:12. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. How about this one? Proverbs 14:34. Righteousness exalts a nation. The Lord meant all of those things. And when a nation finds that kind of position in their hearts before the Lord, those are the results that can be expected and will come. Verse 15. Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. Verse 16. And he went on a circuit year by year to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all these places. Verse 17. Then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there. Ramathaim Zophim. Remember that? He would return to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also he judged Israel, and he built there an altar to the Lord. So again, this was for judging civil and spiritual matters. This was government work. This was ministry work, all wrapped up in the same thing. It was settling court cases. It was giving Bible studies and revealing truth from the scriptures. It was itinerant ministry, which means traveling ministry. And it was scheduled ministry. I don't know why this just really impresses me that Samuel had this ministry circuit so organized, so scheduled. He did the same thing every year. He made this same path. At a certain time in the year, he'd be in Bethel. Another time of the year, Gilgal. Another time of the year, Mizpah. And then he would return in that circuit back home. So that's just impressive. Very organized. He would make his rounds. He would go to these locations and that would give the folks that were closest to those locations a little bit shorter travel to get to him. They could save up their cases for when he came to town. Now, with that said, this circuit, if you look at this on an Old Testament Bible map, it doesn't really cover a whole lot of ground. He's not traveling very far from his home in Ramah. It did do a better job of covering mid and northern Israel. So those folks had a shorter distance to get to Samuel when he was in circuit. But the folks down south, southern Israel, they still had a very far distance. There wasn't any of these cities that were really close to them. The closest would be Ramah. So maybe it was just that, you know, they had all year or a bigger portion of the year to come up to Ramah where Samuel lived to receive judgment or advice, counsel, Bible study, whatever it was that they needed. I don't know. All I know is that it must have worked. Otherwise, I think Samuel would have extended his circuit and he didn't do that. So just a good system for the nation of Israel. And we get to end here with this statement. And they lived happily ever after. I mean, they're just trouble-free until the end of the life of Samuel. Now, when we come to the next chapter, Samuel is in his old age, and trouble will start to brew in his old age. There's going to be an issue, but just soak this in. For a very long time, all was well in Israel. How often do you get to read that in the Bible? How often have you seen that in the history of the world? Not that often. So just soak that in and enjoy that for the week. And next year we'll deal with, next week. Next week. Don't wait till next year. Come back next week. We will deal with the next problem. All right, let's stand and let's pray.